Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Most of the products we use to clean our homes and our bodies and the plastic containers that hold many of those products contain chemicals. And those chemicals are largely unregulated in the United States. For the first time in nearly 40 years, Congress is addressing chemical regulation in the U.S. Coming up, we'll hear from the chemical makers and we'll also hear from a proponent for tougher regulations. Joining me now is Environmental Working Group Senior Analyst Sonia Lunder. Welcome to the show, Sonia.
Hi, nice to be here with you.
So how many chemicals are we talking about, really?
Wow. That's a difficult question to answer, partially because no one's keeping a very careful count of them. But, you know, the highest number we talk about were maybe 80,000 chemicals that are in commerce, meaning that they're imported into the United States, they're made in the United States, and they're used as the building blocks for the consumer products and for, you know, all the things that we buy and consume. We don't know for sure if that's true. There's some reporting requirements, but they're for the chemicals that are used in really high volume. We know that since 1976, when the Toxic Substances Control Act was passed, EPA has reviewed 23,000 new chemicals. And those would be things that weren't in use when TSCA was passed and that chemical companies wanted permission to start. But we have a serious problem with this process that is being used in the United States to review and assess the safety of chemicals. And we know with those 23,000 new chemicals, for example, EPA has only 90 days to review the applications and make a decision about their safety. They rarely deny chemicals out of hand, and they often, in about half of the cases, have absolutely no data about their health and safety when they're making these decisions, and instead rely on good judgment and modeling to try to decide if these chemicals will be harmful to us.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Sonia Lunder of the Environmental Working Group. We're getting started on a conversation about the everyday chemicals in our lives, some 80,000 by one measure, is pretty commonly accepted as permitted for use in the U.S. Let's talk about that permitting process. You're saying 23,000 new chemicals since the Toxic Substances Control Act went into effect about 40 years ago. You say that EPA has only 90 days to review them. What does a review even involve?
Well, it's really voluntary. If the manufacturers have developed health and safety data about the chemical's immediate threat to your health, like will it burn your eyes or your skin, will it scar your lungs, will it cause allergies, that type of information is usually lacking. In about half of the cases, there's no health and safety data. Even the most simple toxicity test is to see how much you have to feed to a lab animal before it dies, which is, you know, a very gross measure of gross meaning crude, sorry.
And
also
gross,
probably
yeah.
kind of gross yeah. measure of what a chemical will do to you. We're, you know, as health advocates, I work for an advocacy organization, we're looking at the other end of it. We're looking at, you know, whether, you know, kids are developing food allergies or ADD as a result of, you know, changes in their environments, you know, for some of these diseases that we see increasing in the population. And they're very subtle and they require, you know, honing in on those types of effects, toxic effects on kids is very detailed and requires a lot of study. But, you know, it's a gross mismatch between what we know about chemicals when EPA makes the decision to allow them on the market and what type of uses they may go on to have in commerce and what kind of exposure we may go on to have to them. We know when we look in American people's bodies, when we look at our blood or our urine for signs of chemical exposure, we can detect hundreds of industrial chemicals in us. And no one, you know, from the public health end really knows how to grapple with or understand what the effect of those chemicals individually or as mixtures may be on our health. So we have these pressing questions mm-hmm. about protecting American health in, you know, and at a very high level. We don't want any kinds of increase in disease and allergy because of a chemical used in plastic wrap. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, when EPA is taking its first, and in many cases, its only look at chemical safety, it has very, very little information.
What do you mean by voluntary? What's the voluntary part of it? They don't have to submit them to the EPA?
If you have data, you need to submit it, but there's no requirement to create a body of information to do testing about a chemical. And industry, you know, says a lot of these chemicals will never be successful. We're getting approval to make them, and many won't go on to be widely used. And that's true, but there's no process, no simple and effective process for EPA to take a second look at those things that end up in baby water bottles or in food containers or in deodorants or any number of things. Now, that's focusing on the chemicals that have been put into commerce in the last 20 years, but a lot of the things, actually longer, but a lot of the chemicals that we also are exposed to daily or that are the workhouses of, or workhorses of our, of the plastics industry or other things like that, mm-hmm. were actually already on the market when the Toxic Substances Control Act were passed. And there's actually been no look at their safety. They were assumed to be safe, and there's no real process of going back to evaluate those chemicals. So there's an incredible mismatch here, and we're very behind in getting basic information about the chemicals that we are exposed to daily as consumers and trying to really understand which may be affecting our health and then having the tools to change the market or get them out of products when we find that there's a problem.
How many chemicals has the agency, the US EPA, ever banned?
Very small number. I actually
like
wrote a blog this
dozens?
Summer because I think PCBs
okay.
would be the example. And if there are a couple more, so be it. But uh-huh. one really key example here is asbestos, which is known to cause cancer in people, which is still manufactured and put in, into products. Incredibly restricted now. But at one point, EPA tried to ban asbestos, said, we know this causes cancer in people. We know workers are exposed. We know it lingers in the environment. And mm-hmm. we know for some people, very little asbestos exposure can kill you. And in fact, my grandfather was killed by working with asbestos and having it destroy his lungs. And EPA tried to ban asbestos, and actually under the Toxic Substances Control Act, lost in court. EPA was found to not have really investigated all the alternatives to banning asbestos and choosing the option that would be least burdensome to the industry.
Why is that necessary that the EPA be responsible for finding an alternative to a toxic substance?
That is the way the law is written now. And choosing the option of restricting the chemical that is least burdensome to industry. If there's any other solution short of a ban, EPA is mandated to take it. Now, here as a public health advocate, I can't answer your question with a really strong, justifiable reason, because we think the law is completely unfair and the law is really dangerous and reckless with our health. I don't think there's a great answer to that question, actually.
What was the goal of this proposed update of the Toxic Substances Control Act? I know it's not called the same thing, but that's what they're doing. That's what they're working on in Congress right now. What's the overarching goal to address those kinds of issues, those kind of dichotomies of that we just talked about?
Yeah, the system is broken, and I think there's widespread acknowledgement that the system is not working. It's even bringing industry to the table because there's efforts to harmonize trade between the U.S. and Europe, and that's being, really hampered by the fact that there is no review of chemical safety in the U.S., and the European standard is much higher for developing data and reviewing chemicals, particularly those that are the most widely used in commerce. I think the industry is also facing the fact that state by state, there are actions now to ban toxic chemicals, starting with those that we know that are most harmful to human health and where there's the strongest evidence that they're actually affecting people, Americans, and oftentimes these effects are felt by children. Our children's bodies are less developed. They're less able to break down and get toxic chemicals out, and small changes to the brain and the nervous system and the reproductive systems during childhood can lead to permanent changes and long-term diseases as adults. So the industry is facing state-by-state restrictions. They are seeing the value, I think, of getting a system that's more standardized and more effective and not dealing with 48 rules or it's a smaller number of states actually that are really taking a look at these, but not trying to maintain different products for each state that they're selling.
Right. But apparently the language, correct me if I'm wrong, would eclipse state laws. So if you had a more stringent state laws, I think it's in California, Maine. Yeah. I'm not sure. I know California, but maybe you move there because you want to live in a state that has more stringent rules. It would eclipse those rules.
Completely. So there's, I think, consensus there needs to be change, but there's unfortunately a huge gap between the changes we're seeking in the advocacy community to actually strengthen the rulemaking process, give EPA the power to get harmful chemicals off the market, and then also respect all the work that's been done by states. We have states like Washington, Maine, California, where they've actually invested years and taken an effort to evaluate chemical safety and to get particularly harmful chemicals and products off the market. So there's a huge issue with preemption and whether or not an overhauled bill would actually keep states from doing their own evaluation and taking action. And that's one of several aspects of the proposed new bills and bills that we would vigorously dispute.
Another issue is that the law still would not be able to force companies to disclose the names of potential toxic chemicals in the products. So that would be status quo then.
Yeah, there are a lot of aspects of secrecy that are being hammered out in these new drafts. And one thing that we're very concerned about would be efforts to allow chemical data, chemical identities, and health and safety data to be secret, only disclosed to the EPA and in some cases to state governments and even emergency responders could have difficulty getting information depending on which versions of these bills you're looking at. For us, that's really problematic. We need full transparency. We need advocacy groups to be able to look at data that are submitted to EPA and see, if there's a study showing that, the mice are dying of cancer, we need to know what chemical was causing that. There's been a ton of work within the advocacy world to just try to shine a light on this problem. And it's only when the consumers start realizing the reckless use of chemicals in consumer products, only with this kind of transparency have we been able to even elevate this discussion and start calling for changes to the law. So we would oppose all these efforts to keep chemical identity, health and safety data secret from the public.
My guest is Sonia Lunder. She's a senior analyst at the Environmental Working Group. Coming up, we're going to hear from the chemical industry, from the Society of Chemical Manufacturers and Affiliates. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has banned about 5 of the more than 80,000 chemicals permitted for use in the U.S. They are in our cleaning products, our grooming products, and all sorts of plastic containers. For the first time in nearly 40 years, Congress is taking up the issue. Still with us is Sonia Lunder, senior analyst at the Environmental Working Group. And joining us now is the CEO of the Society of Chemical Manufacturers and Affiliates, Lawrence Sloan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
The proposed new law would require the EPA to weigh costs to industry before limiting the use of a chemical in children's products. How do you see that working?
Well, the new regulations that we're talking about, particularly the House bill, is going to look at the concept of risk. And the one thing that I want to emphasize up front is that risk is a combination of the hazardous nature of a chemical and also the exposure. And both the House bill and the Senate bill are based on the risk-based principle. So when you're looking at products that are being used in children's products, you need to be careful about what the concept of risk is all about. We've got a very strong bill in the Senate right now that has both bipartisan support from the Democrats and the Republicans, and we have support from a broad array of disparate groups, including many of the medical associations and the Environmental Defense Fund. And so we find that there's a need for TSCA reform, and we find that these bills will give the EPA more authority to conduct the testing that's necessary to screen these products, some of which go into children's applications.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that not all of these products, all of these chemicals, are used in equal measure.
Absolutely not. We must understand that TSCA is based on the analysis of industrial chemicals, not consumer. So in other words, and this does not include pesticides, it does not include food chemicals, mm-hmm. where the exposure is much higher. It's really designed for industrial chemicals, some of which are considered intermediates that never even touch the consumer.
And of course, Lawrence Sloan is referring to the 40-year-old Toxic Substances Control Act. If you have a question or comment out there, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Lawrence Sloan, what is the economic argument against tougher regulation of these chemicals? Some groups are calling for a lot tougher regulation. They're disappointed in the direction that the legislation is going. What's the economic argument against that tougher regulation?
You know, actually, it's interesting, Ann, because the chemical associations that span the variety of the supply chain from the upstream petrochemicals all the way down to the formulated products, adhesives, soaps, detergents, et cetera, we support TSCA reform. We believe that TSCA, as it stands, needs to be improved upon. And we feel that this measure, these bills, both in the House and in the Senate, are going to give the EPA greater authority to provide the testing that's necessary to screen the chemicals into what's considered high priority risk and low priority risk.
What?
And right now, the EPA doesn't have that authority.
Yeah, is there a ban on the EPA doing that? What's lacking in authority?
No, there's not a ban per se, but the EPA has to go through a rulemaking procedure, which is very complicated. And unfortunately, the forefathers of TSCA really didn't give the EPA as much authority and autonomy to require health and safety testing up front. These bills, particularly the one in the House, give the EPA authority to do that upfront testing. And one other issue I want to mention is that the chemical industry is supportive of, and SOCMA in particular, supportive of requiring that the downstream chemical producer, this would be the company that's going to formulate your soaps and detergents, mm-hmm. we would like them to have the authority by the EPA to provide test data. Right now, the downstream customer, the chemical company that our members sell to, is not required to provide test and exposure data or use data to the EPA. So we're saying give the EPA more authority to collect health and safety data and also give the EPA authority to get data from the downstream companies that are buying these chemicals and making formulated products.
What do we know about how chemical companies test their products for everyday use as it is?
Well, there's a combination of procedures that are used. There's actual physical testing that's done on animals, for example. But there's also something called read-across. And that means that if a chemical is in the same toxicological class as another, and the data is known for that other class, then they can read across and extrapolate that health and safety data for a chemical that has a very, very similar structural property.
And when you say that you support downstream chemical producers having to provide test data, would that be the sole evidence that EPA would have to rely on?
No, there is data that's being produced by the original chemical manufacturers themselves. Let me explain a little bit further. The SOCMA members are making a product, a chemical, that goes into a finished formulated product. So, for example, the UV inhibitor in a sunscreen is based on a chemical that one of a SOCMA member might make, or the emulsification of a particular skin cream, or the colorant, or the biocide that goes into something which ultimately ends up in the consumer's shopping cart. Mm-hmm. Our members are making those active ingredients that go into those formulated products. And so the bill in the House right now, Chemicals and Commerce Act, is going to give the EPA greater authority on its own to require those companies to test those ingredients that go into those formulated products and also allow the EPA to go downstream and go to those formulated product companies, the consumer product companies, if you will, that make mm-hmm. soaps, detergents, and so forth, and collect that data for us.
Sonia Lunder of the Environmental Working Group, are you asking for more than that?
Definitely. We want several improvements to the bill that's been circulating. We think the unreasonable risk standard, which is in TSCA, in some of the proposed upgrades to the bill, is not protective enough, doesn't weigh out in court, and we want a higher level of protection for human health. In the pesticide type review and laws, there's a higher protection for human health, and it's written in as a reasonable certainty of no harm. We think for a lot of these chemicals, the exposures are massive, and there is this big disconnect between the companies who are making the chemical and those who buy it and put it into a children's crib mattress. And we're not good enough, and we're not making those links, and there's not a responsibility for either part, the chemical makers or the people who are using them to make the final products, to stay in touch and to figure out which of those chemicals will ultimately be in our homes and will be breathing in or in eating or ingesting, day after day. So we also want a minimum requirement for data set. This is talking about increasing EPA's ability to ask for data.
Yeah.
We also think that because of the fact that so many chemicals in commerce are untested or don't have the basic information about their safety, we aren't as good as we should be at predicting which chemicals will cause harm based on the existing body of knowledge, and that it will actually take a lot more health and safety data in order to refine our models and to get better at predicting what the downstream toxic effects of chemicals might be.
Lawrence Sloan, the Society of Chemical Manufacturers and Affiliates, of which you're CEO, are they comfortable with the EPA requiring more information than they're providing now?
Yes, absolutely. I want to leave it up, though, to the EPA scientists and the toxicologists to evaluate the risk of these various chemicals and interpret any standard. They must use what's called a weight of evidence approach.
Mm-hmm.
Neither side wants to create a situation where the EPA could be accused of cherry-picking data. We must be very careful about that. And finally, I want to mention on the House bill that the EPA is already looking at vulnerable subpopulations. This is not just children and pregnant mothers, but also people that live in these lower-income areas where some of these chemical companies exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the House bill does give this some prominence. So we feel that the House bill is a vast status quo of TSCA.
One critic has said that the law would make sure that once the U.S. EPA acts, there would be a lockdown, is the word they use on state action, as they put it, complete and ironclad. There would be no exceptions or exemptions that could allow state action no matter what happens in the future. Do you agree with that characterization, and why in the world would there be a lockdown?
Not at all. I don't know where that sentiment comes from. In fact, as an example, when you talk about the issue of state preemption, as we know, California has some very strict regulations on the books right now, and the pending House bill will allow any existing state regulations to remain on the books. It is not going to undo what's already there.
But would it prevent states from going forward with stricter regulations in the future?
It would allow the federal government to basically supersede a state regulation.
Right.
However, if there was later on test data that was discovered about a particular chemical, it would go through the system and be reevaluated. So, for example, if a chemical is considered a low priority under these bills, again, the EPA will define high versus low risk and have two different categories or two different buckets.
Uh-huh.
Now, let's say you've got a chemical that's in a low priority risk bucket. And let's say down the road there's some evidence that this particular chemical is an issue for a particular vulnerable population. Well, we would then, under these bills, that data would then be allowed to come into the system and be reevaluated. So there's not going to be a lockdown or a once it's determined to be low risk forever and evermore, that will remain in place.
The Redrafted Chemicals in Commerce Act is what it's called. Is that the House measure?
That's the House measure,
yeah.
Correct.
It underscores the need to consider risk to children. We've talked about that, and other disproportionately exposed and vulnerable populations. You mentioned, for instance, people who live near the factories. But public health advocates have said that it doesn't provide a specific framework to do that.
Well, one of the things that we are concerned about in both bills, and I believe in the House bill, it addresses it a little more succinctly, is that Currently, there are not specific deadlines or timeframes in which the EPA must act. And these bills address the fact, particularly the House bill, addresses the fact that we've got to create timelines, okay, for the EPA to act within a certain framework to make these determinations. The issue with that, however, is that the EPA needs to be staffed more comprehensively to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
For all of these changes that are proposed by EWG and some of the other environmental groups out there, many of their demands we support under the current bills. However, the key to this working for everybody is a more comprehensive and well-staffed EPA. Right now, we don't feel that the EPA has enough bodies, enough critical mass to enforce these types of regulations. So we need to figure out a way to staff them up.
Have they been talking about the funding requirements for that?
No, they haven't. And it's interesting because the EPA has been relatively mute on both of these bills. So I think they recognize, like we do, that change is required. But there hasn't really been any dialogue about staffing requirements.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest right now, Lawrence Sloan, CEO of the Society of Chemical Manufacturers and Affiliates. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Another issue that has been raised by critics is that the proposed new language would not enable the EPA to force companies to disclose the names of chemicals in their products. Why shouldn't people know? Do you agree? I mean, is that how you understand it? And if so, why shouldn't we know what's in the products?
Okay, this is a really complicated issue, but I'm going to try to simplify it for the listeners. When you are naming a chemical, many times, more often than not, the name of the chemical will actually give a chemist an understanding of how that chemical is being manufactured. Now, in the chemical sector, patents are very rare. So what happens is that chemicals must rely on trademark protection. Trademark protection is very tenuous at best. So if you are spending years and millions of dollars developing a new molecule and you name that chemical, and that chemical's name will tell you how that product is being manufactured, somebody from another country, such as China, can go online and they can basically reverse engineer the chemical based on the name of it. So we're saying that the name of the chemical per se is not necessary that the public know what it is. However, there is a generic nomenclature that can be developed and that has been discussed with the EPA that would be a substitute. It's more important that the health and safety information be disclosed to the public with what's called a generically structural descriptive name. So we're very concerned about the actual scientific name of a chemical because that can give somebody, a foreign competitor, an understanding of how it's being manufactured, and then that original inventor will go out of business.
And that's completely understandable why that would be a problem in business and commerce. But what about people who don't trust business will somebody know what the makeup of the chemical is that's in the business of protecting the public?
Yes. Those that are in the industry will very well know if the chemical is named based on its structural formation, they will understand how it's being made. We've got to understand the fact that most of the innovation in the chemical industry originates here in the United States. We have far more trademarks and trade secrets and patents, for that matter, in the chemical sector than anywhere else in the world. And what we're finding is that there are countries out there that will go to any means possible to try to sabotage that intellectual property that American companies have spent years developing. And really, when you get right down to it, we absolutely want to be careful about the health and safety implications of all of our chemicals, but we also have to balance that against the innovative spirit of Americans and the country itself, and then the jobs that are created in all these communities throughout these chemical companies and the entire supply chain.
Right. What about the global supply chain, and how well do American companies and the chemicals that they develop, how are they working with, say, the European Union in matching the requirements over there?
Well, as you may know, Europe has something called REACH, which is the Registration, Evaluation, Authorization, and Restriction of Chemicals Act. and this has been on the books now since 2007. We have found evidence that as a result of REACH, the chemical industry in Europe has been severely impacted. It's been adversely affected. There are many chemicals that are no longer being put into commerce in Europe, and there are many companies here in the United States that have decided that it is just not worth the barriers to entry to continue to sell in Europe. So when you look at the global environment for chemical risk management, you have TSCA in the United States, which, again, we believe should be reformed. And both of these bills, the House and the Senate, do go quite a long ways towards the concerns of the EWG and some of the other environmentalists. It's not perfect, but we feel it's a lot better than what's currently on the books.
And some have argued that tougher regulations would stimulate innovation in green chemistry.
Uh-huh.
Is there a growth there that's a growth potential there that's going untapped because there's not a challenge to the status quo?
That's an excellent question. And let me just say that the American companies are always looking for green chemistry. You know, the EPA published its 12 principles of green chemistry several years ago. And I can tell you that SOCMA members remain very innovative and looking for ways to do things greener. We have companies that have developed green solvents for dry cleaning, as an example. We have a variety of applications that are being developed that are considered less toxic to the environment and to the human health and safety. If you are developing a green chemical, we have to be careful about the fact that that's going to be considered a new chemical. It's going to have to go through the pre-manufacturer notice or new chemicals program. And how are we going to safeguard the security of that chemical? If you're going to disclose the name of that green chemical, that's going to decimate that invention. So going back to your last question, green chemistry figures very prominently into the whole issue of chemical identity.
Oh, okay. So when you say it's green, you're suggesting how it's made.
Absolutely. And so when you're developing a green chemical, it's going to be given a certain name,
mm-hmm.
and it's possible that that could be reverse engineered just per my earlier argument. We can't let perfect be the enemy of good. And so we recognize that there are things that continue to need to be tweaked in these regulations. However, we really support these two bills as a starting point that does figure in some of the demands and requirements of the NGOs that are out there. To Sonia's point, and addressing subpopulations and also just maintaining the innovative spirit of the American companies.
Lawrence Sloan, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having us.
Lawrence Sloan, he's the CEO of the Society of Chemical Manufacturers and Affiliates. We'll continue our conversation about efforts at the federal level to amend, change the laws that govern the chemicals at use in our society. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Federal lawmakers are at work on new regulations for chemicals commonly found in water bottles, soaps, and many other household goods. It's been almost 40 years since Congress addressed chemical regulation nationwide. Manufacturers and consumer advocates say that reform is long overdue, but some question if the proposed new laws go far enough. Still with us is Sonia Lunder, senior analyst at the Environmental Working Group, and joining us now is the director of the environmental health group Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families, Andy Egregious. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Thank you.
Some have said that the new legislation would take the country backwards in chemical oversight. Do you agree with that? And if so, how does it take it backwards?
Sure. I mean, the legislation really, it's very unfortunate because you've had states and businesses throughout the country and certainly our trading partners in Europe, all of whom have responded to the science showing that very common chemicals contribute to many of the chronic illnesses that we see, as well as environmental damage in the American population. But then you have a bill in Congress that instead of joining that parade and being a part of strengthening public health protections, instead would roll back the protections that exist at the state level now in exchange for a federal program where the rules have really, with rules that have been devised and favor the chemical industry and don't align at all with the standards that the public health community, including pediatricians and National Academy of Sciences, have said are needed. So we would have a weakening of state laws, and the federal law would still not improve. And the simplest way of describing how the federal law wouldn't be improved is that it uses the very same standard for action by EPA that is in the current law. And under that standard, the EPA couldn't even regulate asbestos. And so the bottom line on this bill is that the EPA would still be unable to impose the most basic common sense restrictions on those chemicals, even those chemicals that we already know are toxic, let alone the ones that we discover as we sift through the chemicals and try to test them and understand them. They wouldn't be able to act, and yet states would be prohibited from acting. And even some of the other details of how federal law works now are weakened in the direction of the chemical industry, with less disclosure of chemicals by the use of confidential business information and less oversight of the new chemicals as they come onto the market. So that's why we feel very strongly that the legislation is a step backward.
Sonia Lunder, I was surprised that the U.S. EPA hasn't weighed in on any of this. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a highly political conversation, and they're being torn in several directions. We do know that in recent testimony, Jim Jones, who runs the EPA chemical safety type programs, estimated that about 1,000 chemicals currently on the market in everyday products would need review, are urgently in need of review because of their potential threat to human health and to the environment. So that's one of EPA has been vocal about the shortcomings in its authorities, mm-hmm. and particularly in for asking for new data, they face a really high standard of being able to make an argument that there's a risk before they actually can require new testing, in the basic health and safety data for chemicals that they would actually need to be able to prove whether or not there is a risk or not. So they've been, fairly vocal in naming the problem, talking about their lack of authority. This idea of 1,000 chemicals that are in urgent need of review, I think, was a real wake-up call to many people who thought that the chemical industry and that EPA had this issue pretty sorted out. Although, they haven't been as specific maybe as some of the advocates and other people in Congress in naming shortcomings of the bills under development. But kind of what you would expect.
And what about their ability to properly staff these efforts anyway?
Well, that's a huge issue, and one we're actually probably in good agreement with Lawrence Stone. This will be a time-consuming and resource, we'll have to commit some resources, mm-hmm. and effort and, PhDs to getting this issue right. And I think when the chemical industry is raising that point, we know that it's an issue of broad agreement and something that will need to happen in order to make this system work.
Let's hear from Peggy in Worthington. Hi, Peggy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is an anecdotal story, but my daughter has, of course, lived in the United States most of her life, and at about the age 30, she moved to Europe. And some amazing things happened shortly after she left the United States. She started sweating, and she always had an issue of not sweating. She said she sweated for 2 days, just buckets. She dropped it about 60 pounds without trying. She's had a weight problem all her life. Her asthma went away, and the rash on her upper arms went totally away. She's in the best health she's ever been, and she is convinced it's what she's been eating or breathing or drinking here in this country. In fact, she's actually decreased her physical exercise regime because she just doesn't need it. She used to walk about 8 miles a day and could not keep weight off, developed asthma and everything else. Mm. And when she refuses to visit for a long period of time because she's just so afraid of what's allowed in this country. And I said, why read all the labels? And she goes, well, it's so joyful for her that she can go shopping or buy makeup and she doesn't have to read the labels and be an amateur chemist, because the country takes care of it. They just don't allow.
Well, the whole European Union, right?
Right.
Okay.
And unless you think I'm crazy, I mean, my husband retired after over 30 years working as a chemist, and he wholeheartedly supports my daughter and what she's saying and everything else.
Okay.
So,
well, thanks for that anecdote. Yeah. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Take care, Peggy.
That's
pretty interesting. One proponent of tougher restrictions has said that there's a strong body of scientific evidence that toxic chemicals have contributed to all kinds of problems in children. Andy Egregious, what can you tell us about that?
Sure. It's a number of bodies, including, you know, some that are fairly authoritative. The President's Cancer Panel, which was a panel appointed by George W. Bush, came out a couple of years ago saying that we have drastically understated the role that environmental contamination and chemicals play in the cancer incidence in this country. And one of the things they recommended was meaningful reform of the Toxic Substances Control Act. Not the kind of reform that's on the table with this bill, but the kind that would really sort through which chemicals are causing problems and devise interventions or restrictions that would prevent them from doing that. And you have other groups that have weighed in, the American Academy of Pediatrics, having looked at the research detail. They issued detailed recommendations for how chemicals should be evaluated and then restricted in order to protect public health from the different chronic illnesses that the evidence keeps pointing to, including infertility, learning disabilities, and others. And yet their recommendations are completely ignored in this legislation.
Oh, can you give me an example of something that is in common use in the United States that's banned in Europe?
Well, here's an example. Going back to Peggy, your caller, you know, we see a lot of differences between the U.S. and Europe in terms of addressing toxic chemicals, cosmetics, pesticides. And, you know, it is hard to, you know, as a scientist looking at the literature, see major differences in health trends. But one thing that's notable and relevant to this conversation is that there are some publications indicating that in the U.S. there's a lot more allergy to formaldehyde, and the rates may be double what they are for Europeans. And formaldehyde's in a lot of consumer products, but one aspect that the scientists have kind of questioned and pointed to is the use of formaldehyde as a preservative in body care products, in cleaning products, and even in, you know, non-wrinkle clothing. Sometimes formaldehyde or formaldehyde-like chemicals can be used to make clothing that's wrinkle-free. And the pervasive use of those products in the United States just leads to this low-grade exposure that causes people to develop allergies, whereas in Europe, those chemicals, the formaldehyde-related chemicals, are more restricted in consumer products. And this may be one of those examples where you actually can see how the chemical restrictions actually make real differences in people's health. Once you're allergic to formaldehyde, then you would find it very difficult to use a lot of different body care products, cleaning products. We know people commonly use formaldehyde-based hair straighteners in the United States that can cause really serious allergic reactions. And your life becomes more difficult in this way that's hard. And because when ingredients aren't on the label, it can be a real trial and error process to figure out what types of consumer products you need to avoid.
Andy Egregious, did you have anything to add to that?
No, that was a great summary of, I think the bottom line is that you have our, you know, biggest trading partner in the European Union moving forward, and you have the United States falling behind. And we've had several incidences where, in many ways, the U.S. is behaving more like what we, you know, used to call the third world country, the place where the more toxic products are allowed, the more toxic materials are allowed. And I think no one likes that idea of that's what the United States of America is reduced to.
We have an email from Dustin in Westerville. He writes, in the interest of the greater public good, we should invest more public funds to develop these new chemicals and then release the findings as public information and let industry compete to produce those products at a competitive price. This would be great for the pharmaceutical industry, too, and may shift industry to make more beneficial drugs and chemicals, not just designer and highly profitable products. I don't know if that's possible.
Well, what's interesting about that?
Has that been discussed?
Well, there have been in previous reform proposals funding and incentives for what they call green chemistry, or chemicals that are designed from the beginning to be inherently safe. In other words, that they have a low hazard, and it sort of doesn't matter how you use them because they're inherently safe, so you don't have to take all these precautions. And I think one of the problems is that the degree to which the private sector is there's a demand for green chemistry, it gets held back by the fact that the current system, really there's no penalties for using very toxic chemicals. So if you're designing a product that might rely on a very toxic chemical, and if it's not really being regulated by the federal government, it's sort of up to you to choose that alternative. It might cost more, et cetera. But there's nothing that the federal government is doing right now to internalize the costs of that, to basically say, hey, wait a second. If these are chemicals that are linked to health problems, we should be restricting them. And if we had that kind of system, I think you would see those people who are really innovating and are creating the safer chemicals would have more access to the market. There'd be more demand for their products because we were taking action against the dirtier and more unhealthy chemicals.
There, you can see it in the grocery store every day. There seems to be a huge influx of so-called green products, particularly in the cleaning section. Is everybody convinced that those products are necessarily safer or greener?
This is Sonia. My organization, Environmental Working Group, has taken a very close look at a lot of consumer products. We have an online database where people can look at the ingredients and safety concerns for cosmetics called Skin Deep. We also have a database of 2,000 cleaning products with information about the potential hazards and the ingredients of those. We find in a lot of cases there are some innovative brands that are really shifting away from some of the really harsh chemicals. Mm-hmm. They're also making policies that they will completely list their ingredients and they'll be as specific as possible. And they're shifting away from using those ingredients in detergents that are known to damage the environment or be concerning for human health, the formaldehyde type preservatives and stuff. So we see some good brands, but the claims of natural green, eco-friendly, have no real standard.
There's no regulation
definition
of it.
Yeah. So we find that, and in especially for things like cleaning products, there's no requirement that you put all the ingredients on the label. And some of the things that cause the most allergies or adverse reactions to people are in the fragrance, for example, or in as preservatives, which are often not completely named. So we see some good products, and we see some good brands that are out there trying to innovate, but you wouldn't be able to just read the front of a container necessarily and know that this is something that, this is the best thing out there, this is something I can use without, coughing and having my eyes feel bad. And unfortunately, this puts a lot of burden on the consumers to do their research and to, experiment and see what works, and hope that they're putting a lot of trust into brands instead of having some guarantee that the products are really good.
Andy Agregis, is there any sense about the economic impact of living with these chemicals? Do we know anything about that?
There have been different estimates over the years that it gets into the billions of dollars. If you add up the best estimates of the portion of chronic disease that is linked to chemical exposure, and then what it costs to deal with and treat that disease. So it's a lot of money. That those estimates, even the most conservative, dwarf the estimates of what the impact of regulating the chemicals would be in terms of economic impact. And I don't have the numbers handy, but people can look that up. We have a report on our website that gets into that as well. The health report is the tag on it. But I think the bigger thing is, for most people, it's not just a dollars and cents issue. There's a lot of human suffering that occurs with people who are having significant illnesses, childhood cancer. Mm-hmm. One of our coalition partners called Stupid Cancer is young adult cancer survivors, and they specialize really in drawing attention to what it really means to have more and more people mm-hmm. living with cancer. So it's good that they are living, but that there's real issues with it. There's real effects it has on the quality of your life, and that if regulating chemicals in a real way would reduce that, that's something we should do, and we should do it soon. And the in front of us doesn't do that.
Andy Agregis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Andy Agregis, he's the director of the environmental health group, Safer Chemicals and Healthy Families. And Sonia Lunder, thanks for sticking with us this hour. We appreciate it.
It's been fun.
Sonia Lunder is with the Environmental Working Group. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.